the idea of identity crisis, is a simple consequence of the fact that the Jacobi identity holds for any sort of operators. The commutator of A with the commutator of B and C plus cyclically permuted is always zero, no matter what it is that A, B, and C stand for. And so the Jacobi identity is seen to be of the same denominator, who's of the same kind as the first Bianchi identity. Also, the second Bianchi identity is something that is built into the framework. Remember that these equations are built into the differential geometric framework. They are not part of general relativity. We couldn't choose those equations to be any different. Whereas the Einstein equation, we could choose to be different, guided by experiment, perhaps. But as long as we live in differential geometry, those equations will hold. So they have a different status, much like the homogeneous Maxwell equations have a different status from the inhomogeneous ones. Because the homogeneous ones simply express that the field strength tensor is, the field strength tensor is an exact form. It is deriving from the one form A, and therefore if you differentiate that again, you get zero. Now, what do these things look like? Let's just collect a few properties of the Riemann curvature tensor and the Bianchi identities in coordinates. What if we write out those equations in a chart? So let's assume that there is no torsion. That will simplify about the Bianchi identities part. And let us use a chart, and let us choose those as bases in the tangent and cotangent spaces. In this case, as it's not hard to verify, the first Bianchi identity simply becomes that statement, where this JKL within round bracket means it's the cyclic sum of all the terms that you get by simply cyclically commuting through those indices. The second Bianchi identity is an identity about the covariant derivative of the Riemann curvature tensor. If you remember here, we have a covariant derivative in this. And here that is zero. So we only have this piece. So we have this equation in coordinates reading that. There are other very useful properties of the Riemann curvature tensor with this choice of coordinate, and with this choice of basis, and they look like that. The Riemann curvature tensor is anti-symmetric in those two components. This is going to be very important because those two components are covariant and they are anti-symmetric. It will later turn out, in fact in this lecture today, that this means that we can view the Riemann curvature tensor as being a two-form, but not a regular two-form, because if you identify those two as belonging to covariant and asymmetric two tensor, then you're still left with those two indices, right? So it will be a special type of two-form. It will be a one-one tensor value two-form. Because after you've identified those two components as a two-form, you're still left with the contravariant covariant index. So whereas in a regular two-form, you feed a few tension vectors and you get out a number. Here, you feed two tangent vectors, and you get out of the number. You get out a tensor that has an upper and lower index. And we will do this identification because, as you remember, differential forms have a lot of special properties. They are the only things that can be integrated, because their transformation properties are those of an integral measure. And secondly, differential forms have a lot of other nice algebraic structure to them. You can do the exterior derivative on them, the full derivative on them, the Hodge star, all this business works on differential forms. And it works on the differential forms that are not scalar values or tensor values like those. But I'm just looking ahead. We will do this more in detail later on. Then you also have that you can, you also have the anti-symmetry in the first three indices here, if you pull this index down. This is, by the way, abstractly speaking, that equation. And also, you can swap the first three indices for the second three indices. ij replace kl, and there's a symmetry in this. This is important when you describe the shape of a manifold through what is called a sectional curvature, because then you have a symmetric matrix here, and once you have a symmetric, you can view this as a symmetric double matrix, where ij, you know, one index, double index, kl, you know, one double index, right? So I runs from 0 to 3, let's say, and j runs from 0 to 3, which is to say that the combination ij has 16 components. So you can view this as a 16 by 16 matrix, which is a symmetric, and therefore can be diagonal. Right? And then you can look at its eigenvalues, for example, and there is this business called sectional curvature, sectional curvatures, which are describing more or less directly the target forces. And if that's how you want to describe the curvature of a space-time, then you use this property, view this as a Riemann curvature tensor as a 16 by 16 matrix that's symmetric, and so on. Also very important are certain contractions of the Riemann curvature tensor that you have probably already seen. Here's the Ricci tensor. So you contract the contravariant index with the second covariant index, and what you obtain is the Ricci tensor. The curvature scalar is what you obtain when you contract the Ricci tensor now with the metric completely. So this R is a scalar. The second Bianchi identity, just show it to you again. Second Bianchi identity is this one. If you write that out, what it means, you see this is a cyclic sum. If you write out this cyclic sum and use symmetry properties of the indices, you can convince yourself within two lines that this equation holds. This is the covariant derivative. This is just the cyclic sum of the second Bianchi identity, but you've used the symmetry properties of the Riemann curvature tensor to obtain this simplified version where you just have two terms of this. So here's the Ricci tensor, here's the Riemann curvature scalar. That's a covariant derivative, and it's just a conic adductor. I could have written GIK, but that's of course the same thing. This equation is very important historically, not just practically, but also historically, because when Einstein first developed general relativity, he at first got it wrong. And he realized it was because he hadn't taken into account that this equation would hold. And once he saw that, he realized what he had to do. We will later see exactly how that plays out. But for the moment, let's just say it's a very important equation, and therefore this particular two tensor here is given a special name. It's the Einstein tensor. And what the second Bianchi identity is saying is that the covariant derivative of the Einstein tensor with respect to K, and then contracted, everything contracted here, equal to zero. That will turn out to be a covariant divergence that is zero, and that will play the role of the analog of energy momentum conservation at CPC. In general relativity, there is really no energy momentum conservation, but this is the next best thing. As you will see, you're not supposed to know exactly what that means at the moment, I'm just motivating why this is important. Remember our overall strategy. We want to describe Riemannian manifolds. We want to describe the shape of Riemannian manifolds. One way to do that was to specify a metric, because specifying the metric means that you specify the distance between infinitesimally close points, and integrate that up, and get the distance between any two points, the invariant distance, that is. And having all the distances obviously tells you how the manifold looks like. Alternatively, we said that the non-trivial shape of space-time is also I can also be specified by specifying how parallel transport is computed. Let's just juxtapose the two images here. If you have a space time that is, let's say, mostly flat, but it has a bulge in the middle, and you can recognize that using the metric picture by noticing that some points have a larger than expected distance from them. It's because the shortest path actually has to go over that bulge. Right? So you recognize that there is a bulge, you recognize the existence of curvature in this case by the fact that there are non-trivial distances involved. Here, you would recognize the bulge differently. Maybe let's say you're on top of the bulge, you parallel transport, walk down the hill, parallel transport a vector, and then turn around. Remember the example of the Earth, where you walk from the North Pole onto the equator, and then you parallel transport your vector, and you come back up to the top of the hill, and your hand is no longer pointing in the same direction. So in this way, you can also recognize that there's curvature on the space time, or just the space. So curvature, the shape of the manifold was specified in this case through the non-triviality of parallel transport as expressed through the affine connection and the differentiation with respect to parallel transport. And in principle, we had these were totally independent ways of describing a manifold. Now let's for the moment assume that the manifold is specified by having given a metric g. So it's specified by giving a distance relation. Now for that same manifold, there ought to be an affine connection which describes it as well. So then the natural question is, if g is given, how can we find out what the affine connection is that describes the same manifold? So what we need is to mathematically describe the consistency between the parallel transport and metric. Here's the idea. The parallel transport of two vectors has to be such, or automatically is such, that the inner product of the two vectors stays the same as the parallel transport. See, if you remember that what the affine connection does for us, it tells us how a vector does as we parallel transport it along a manifold. As we travel on a path on the manifold, we can take a vector along with us. Now what if we take two vectors along with us? One vector pointing in this direction, one vector into another direction. They start out having a particular angle, I don't know, 27 degrees perhaps, relative to another. Now as you parallel transport both vectors along that path of the manifold, if they're really parallel transported, their angle should stay the same, the relative angle, because they're all parallel transported. So the relative angle between the two vectors should always stay 27 degrees if it starts out. In other words, the inner product between the two vectors better be constant as you parallel transport. So the idea then is to make this a condition that write this down as an equation which will help us establish the relationship between the metric description of a manifold and the connection description of the same manifold. Let us consider a path gamma and two vector fields, each a new, which are parallel transported along gamma. So we take one vector field such that as I walk along the path on the manifold, my vector is parallel transported, and what it is at each point is described by the vector field. Similarly, mu is a parallel transport onto parallel vector field, meaning that if I travel on my path and I take the vector mu with me and I compare the parallel transported vector to the vector field mu, I find it always the same. So that is what an auto parallel vector field is. Then let us look at the inner product between eta and mu. So here's the metric. At the point gamma of t, some gamma is the path, gamma of t is the point of the path, g is the metric at the point of the path, And here we look at the vector at the point, at the same point of the path. Here we look at another vector, mu, the same point of the path. And we simply take the inner product. So this thing is a two-fold covariant metric. And here we take a contraband vector, feed that into the metric, get out the number. The inner product is the length of this vector times the length of that vector times the cosine of the angle in the Riemannian case. So this is the inner product between the vectors mu and mu, eta and mu, with respect to the metric v. That inner product, which encapsulates the angle between them, between the two vectors, better be the same all along the path. So as we go along the path, e by dt of that number ought to be zero. Now remember that d by dt of function of the path parameter is the action of the tangent vector. This was how the geometric definition of a tangent vector was related to the algebraic definition of the tangent vector as a derivative. So therefore, this condition is the same as the condition that the covariant derivative of this expression in the direction of the tangent vector is vanishing. So this is the covariant derivative of this expression, which happens to be a scalar, in the direction of gamma dot, in the direction of the path. So this is the covariant derivative in the direction of gamma dot of this thing here. It is a tensor, all right, but it's a zero tensor. It's a scalar. Because we've completely contracted all indices, this happens to be a scalar. Therefore, we might as well write that this is the ordinary derivative. But we can also write that it is the covariant derivative. Because the covariant derivative is the ordinary derivative on scalars. But then remember that the covariant derivative is obeying the Leibniz rule for tensors, which means that we can write out what the covariant derivative of those three terms is. We can apply the covariant derivative on the G, leaving those two invariant, plus leaving that invariant, apply the covariant derivative on eta, and so on. So really, this condition here, the invariance of the angle between two vectors, translates into the statement that this sum here is equal to zero. Covariant derivative of G, covariant derivative of eta, covariant derivative of mu. But this actually will simplify dramatically, because the covariant derivative of eta is vanishing. You see, this is because the covariant derivative of eta in the direction gamma dot, and that's what we do, we differentiate in the direction of gamma dot. See, we covariantly differentiate with respect to the index A, but the index A is contracted with the gamma dot A, which means that we are actually carrying out the covariant derivative in the direction of gamma dot, which is to say that we covariantly differentiate eta in the direction of the path. But by assumption, eta is an autoparallel vector field, which is to say that its covariant derivative in the direction of the path is vanishing. So that expression actually vanishes. Not that the individual thing vanishes, but this contracted with that is vanishing. Eta covariant differentiate contracted with this is vanishing. And similarly, mu also is an autoparallel vector field, so also this contracted with that is vanishing. And we are left, therefore, with the statement that if the affine connection and the metric describe the same manifold, then this equation must hold 0 equal to all of this. This equation, that 0 is equal to all of this, must hold for arbitrary paths on the manifold and arbitrary autoparallel vector fields. But this means that this expression itself has to vanish. Since those are arbitrary, this expression itself is vanish. But this is to say that the covariant derivative of G has to vanish. So the compatibility of the affine connection with the metric means the covariant derivative of G has to vanish in all directions. Because it doesn't matter which direction we choose. And of course the question is, mathematically, this is not trivial. could it be that we can choose a metric G which is simply not describable to an FI connection? Intuitively, we wouldn't expect so. Whatever we choose for G, it's going to describe some manifold, and there's going to be some parallel transport on that manifold, so there ought to be a covariant derivative, there ought to be an affine connection for them. And that is the statement of the fundamental theorem of pseudo-Riemannian geometry. Namely that for every G, there is an affine connection. So for each Riemannian or pseudo-Riemannian manifold, given by a manifold and a metric, there exists a unique affine connection that is torsionless and compatible with G in this sense, namely obeying that the covariant derivative of G is zero, and that connection is called the Levy-Chinita connection. What about the opposite? If you're given an affine connection, can you always find the metric? Yeah, yes. Turns out not so. For example, in electromagnetism, there is an affine connection. It doesn't describe a curved space, which you can tell because there's no metric that corresponds to it. There are affine connections that do not derive from a metric. And also the strong interaction. You have affine connections, but you don't have a metric for it. So in other words, you can quite easily write down affine connections that describe parallel transport in such a way that it cannot be because of space being curved. Even if you allow for torsion, it cannot be done. But whenever you have a metric, G, then you're describing a manifold, well, quite obviously, because we're giving distances between points, and then there is an affine connection that will correspond. This has some philosophical ramifications, perhaps, when you consider what should I quantize? What should I take to be the more fundamental thing, the affine connection or the metric? In my opinion, neither is fundamental, but some people would go for the one or the other.
What happened in the case of torsion?
I'm not entirely sure. I don't know. But remember, there's an essay topic, exploring everything to do with torsion. That might be an interesting question to clarify what is known about the case of torsion. What happens to the fundamental theorem of Riemannian geometry? If you allow, I don't know. So in a chart, how does it look like? Well, the covariant derivative of G vanishing in a chart looks like this. Remember the covariant derivative, and this is the absolute covariant derivative. You know, we are not specifying which direction we are differentiating. Is given by the ordinary derivative, and then because it's covariant, we have two minus signs here, and then we have the Christoffel sequence. Remember, it's just a special case of different covariant differentiating a covariant two tensor. This is how the covariant derivative of a covariant two tensor looks like. Now, if you write the same equation three times, but rename the indices, then we obtain also that equation and this equation. We simply rename the indices three times exactly the same equation. And then we take a negative of the first equation and add to it the second and the third equation, multiply the whole thing by 1/2. That's a trick that goes back to Einstein, but I suppose it mustn't be known to Riemann already. So if you do the sum of those three lines, you obtain that line here. See, those three terms simply get plus this one, minus that one. That's what we have here. And then we have the term gamma, beta, nu, mu. That is this term surviving and that term surviving. And this term gets eaten up with that term, and this term gets eaten up with that term, because you know, this one has a minus sign, this line has a minus sign, that sign has a plus sign. So you get this equation here. And this is what we wanted. Given the metric, we can calculate what the corresponding FI connection is. See, the metric is inverted with the control is on the other side, and you obtain very cleanly the FI connection as a function of the metric. You cannot invert this, as I said. You cannot get the metric as a function of the FI connection. This FI connection, the one that is specified by the metric, is also called the Leydig-Chiliger connection. Now, finally, let's make another push into more abstract mathematics, but then after that push will be done in dimensioning and duplicating. So we will reformulate our results now on a more abstract level. And for that purpose, we will allow arbitrary bases in the tangent and cotangent space. And here, I really have to ask you to forget what you might have heard about differential geometry and general relativity in coordinate systems. It really takes a conscious effort to overcome some prejudices. Let's look at it this way. Remember that how we define tangent vectors. We define tangent vectors as derivations on the algebra of functions that obey the Leibniz rule. But then we also said that the physicist's definition makes sense as well. Choose a coordinate system, etc. And then if you change coordinate system, then the coefficients of the vector, of your tangent vector, change, right? And this can also be taken as a sign that we are dealing with a vector. If it has this transformation property, that's how it works. And similarly, if we have a cotangent vector, it transforms its own way, right? But now think about it. What is the scenario? We have a manifold and a point P on that manifold. At that point P, we have an n-dimensional tangent vector space. It's a vector space attached to this point P. Now, in your imagination, think of a vector in this tangent space. Okay? And if you choose a basis in this tangent space, your vector is going to have some coefficients, right, with respect to the spaces that you may have chosen. Now, what happens to those coefficients if you change chart? Any guesses? So here's the setup again. You choose a point. At the point, you have the tangent vector space. In that tangent vector space, you choose a basis. You choose a vector in the tangent space. And with respect to the basis, it's going to have some coefficients. Now I'm asking, what happens if you choose one chart or the other? What happens to the coefficients?
They should change.
No?
They must change.
No. They don't change. They don't change at all. Because your vector stays the same, your basis stays the same. Why should the coefficients change? It has nothing to do with the chart. Right? I can look at the point of the manifold, look at the tangent vector space there, choose a basis, and I can choose a basis irrespective of any chart. I just choose a basis. And then any given vector is going to have some coefficients with respect to that basis. And those coefficients are whatever the coefficients are. It has nothing to do with the choice of coordinate system. So the reason why we are trained initially to think that if you change basis, that the coefficients of a vector change, is only the following, a very trivial one that you just have to see what's going on. If you choose a coordinate system x, then you may be choosing in the tangent space, for example, automatically these basis vectors, right? So in your tangent space, your vector is going to be described by its coefficients with respect to these basis. And now if you choose another coordinate system, y, then you may be choosing these basis vectors in the same tangent space, cotangent space, you're now choosing those basis vectors. And no wonder that the coefficients of the same vector are now different, because you change basis, right? So ordinarily, two things are linked that don't have to be linked. If you choose a coordinate system x, then instinctively people choose this as the basis for the tangent vector space, right? And then when you choose another coordinate system, you instinctively use those guys as the new basis for the cotangent vector spaces. And so along with the change of coordinates, you are changing bases in your coordination space. And therefore, no wonder that your vector in a coordination space is changing its components. Well, it's because you're changing bases in the coordination space. But in principle, you're totally free to choose whatever basis you like. At any point in time, at every point of the manifold, choose whatever basis you like. It's completely independent of which coordinate system you choose. For example, you may be working with a coordinate system X. This is the basis of the tangent vector space. But you may not be happy with that basis. Maybe you want to work with a different basis that is 3dx0 plus 2dx dx1 plus 7dx3, 1, 2, and I don't know, minus 4dx3. You could do that. Right? I mean, sorry. That might be. Let's see, theta 1 is one basis vector. Okay, this is a linear combination of the usual basis vectors. And then theta 2 would be another linear combination of those basis vectors. And theta 3 in another combination, theta 4 in another combination. If those four are linearly independent, you have a basis. You can choose that basis. So the point I want to make is that we are free to choose our basis. Completely arbitrarily at every point in space. And once we've chosen that basis, any tangent vector or cotangent vector will have some coefficients with respect to that basis, and those coefficients are independent of any choice of coordinate system. Okay. What those bases are, typically, we will express it just this way. We will say that theta 1 is some linear combination of row spaces vectors, for example, in one coordinate system, just to specify which ones we may choose. Okay? But the main thing is that vectors, tensors, have coefficients that are no longer dependent on the coordinate system. So this is going to be a major step here, that we choose, we claim the freedom, we make use of the freedom to choose spaces in the tangent and cotangent and tensor spaces any way we want. The second big point is going to be that we allow differential forms to be tensor vectors. I mentioned it already at the beginning of the lecture today. An ordinary differential form is always scalar vector. It means the following. Take a 3 form, for example. What does it do? Well, you feed it 3 tangent vectors, and out you get a number. Or you feed it 3 tangent vector fields, and out you get a function, which is scalar. But you can imagine differential forms which have some spare indices. So a differential 3 form may be 1/3 tensor value, which means that it's a differential 3 form, and after you feed it 3 tangent vectors, you get out of it a tensor rather than a scalar. We'll do that explicitly very soon. And once we make use of this freedom of identifying some differential form part in tensors, as we indicated before, the Riemann curvature tensor has 2 covariant components that act as symmetric. We will identify that part as a differential form part, and the rest as the values it takes, so that the Riemann curvature tensor will be viewed as a 1-1 tensor valued 2 form. Once we make use of that and of the freedom to choose basis, things can be expressed on a much higher level, and certain equations become much simpler. For example, the Bianchi identities become simpler. So now for that purpose, let us, for the moment, assume again that the affine connection and the metric are completely unrelated. And also let us allow that the torsion might not be 0. Then Let's start with the free choice of bases, so-called moving frames. A moving frame is a choice of bases for each different point of the manifold, and we make that choice. It's not supposed to be automatic with the coordinate system. We don't automatically go with the spaces, but we make our own choice. So moving frame is a set of basis vectors, contravariant basis vectors. So they are going to be basis vectors of the tangent space for every point of the manifold. So for every point of the manifold, we have a tangent space. This is the tangent space, you know, the space of one tensors here. And those guys are going to be bases. So at every point, the manifold, this is going to be four tangent vectors in practice in general relativity. And then having chosen that basis for the tangent spaces, it will be convenient, though not strictly necessary, but it will be convenient to choose for the cotangent vector spaces the dual basis, which we may call theta. So the dual basis is, of course, the basis of the tangent vector space, such that if you evaluate theta I on Ej, you just get Kronecker delta Ij. Remember that for every basis of a vector space, there is a canonical dual basis here. In the dual space, and that's what we would choose. But in principle, we are free to choose a completely unrelated basis in the cotangent vector space, but that's going to make things just unnecessarily complicated. So we choose always a dual basis. In the case of four dimensions, this is also called a vierbein or tetrad, tetrad being the Greek version and vierbein being the German version of it. Vier means four and bein means legs. So it's four legs because if you have four basis vectors, they're supposed to point in four different directions. So like four legs. Now the theta I being forming a basis in the cotangent vector space are also one forms, of course. Because cotangent vectors are one form. So those guys are one forms. And if we apply the exterior derivative on them, then we obtain two forms. You may not be used to this, but you should really see this as a generic case. Remember that if, when you choose a coordinate system x, you use for your basis vectors in the cotangent space the dxi, then the exterior, then they are one form, right? But the exterior derivatives of those guys are obviously zero, right? Because dxi is really the exterior derivative of the coordinate function xi. And therefore, this is really a case of d squared equals zero. However, in the case where we choose those theta arbitrarily, that's not so. Because after all, we will have that the phi of x as a function of x are generally some coefficient function, later I don't know, fc, some coefficient function, well, okay, let's say alpha I j of x dx j. Okay? These guys are a basis of the cotangent vector space, and therefore whatever basis we may want to work with, those basis vectors are linear combinations of those. And there's a function here. And now you see that d theta I of x is generally not zero, because you pick up the differentiation of those coefficient functions here. Okay, so if we have a, if we use a general basis for the space of coordinate, for the space of cotangent vectors, then these are one forms whose exterior derivative is the two form. And let us give an expansion of what that two form is. So the theta, d theta I, is a two form, and all two forms have this form. Since the theta I are bases of one forms, the theta I veg theta j, or theta j veg theta k, are bases of the two forms. We established that long ago. Therefore, whatever two form this is, it is a linear combination of those guys, and the linear combination coefficients we denote by c. The fact that there's a minus 1/2 in there is just a historical convention that is convenient for certain purposes. This c also, in principle, could be a matrix that has symmetric components. But that wouldn't change anything. We can, without restricting generality, require the capital C to be anti-symmetric in J. Because if there was a component that is symmetric, it would drop out of this, because that is anti-symmetric. Remember that every matrix can be decomposed into symmetric plus anti-symmetric part. The symmetric part doesn't enter here, so we set it equal to zero. And if you work in a coordinate system, you get those guys, you choose your basis by choosing those functions, then you work out what that exterior derivative is, and it's pretty easy, right? This is just functions, after all. Nothing special, just functions. You just get comma, k, and do it. right? You get that you have d alpha I j of x veg dxj, right? And what is that? Right? So this would be alpha I j comma epsilon and dx epsilon, right? And so you get those coefficients, this alpha I j, you just have to watch out with the anti-symmetrization here, are essentially those coefficients c. So if you work in a coordinate system, you can work out what those things are. I'm only using this for illustration. Remember that those alpha here derive from that thing here, and that is something that relates our one forms to coordinate systems. But the C themselves can be given without reference to any coordinate system. You could specify your coefficient C without mentioning ever what coordinate system you want to work with. So obviously, those coefficients are going to play an important role here. So they describe the expansion of these two forms that you get from a basis. Now, assume we've chosen our basis at every point, either by defining one forms as linear combinations of those canonical one forms using some function alpha ij of x, and then obtaining the eij as the dual basis to those, or by defining the eij as linear combinations of the canonical basis vectors d by dxi. Either way, we want to do it. So let's say we have chosen some theta and some e. Then we can express our tensors in those bases. So for example, remember that the torsion tensor has two covariant indices and one contravariant indices. So since it has two covariant indices, we can feed it two vectors, and then out we get the contravariant vector, which we then can contract with a covariant vector, and that's what we do here. And what we obtain is the torsion tensor, which you remember has only three components, in the basis that we've chosen, the basis of the theta and the e. So these are actual numbers. At every point on the manifold, those things are actual numbers. Right? It's a matrix with three components, and there are numbers. How do those numbers change as we change the coordinate system? Negative?
Mm-hmm.
Correct. They don't change at all. Okay? These guys, this matrix, doesn't change if you change coordinate system. Because we've chosen our basis in the tangent and cotangent vector spaces. We've chosen that. We've decoupled that from a choice of coordinate system. We've chosen our basis, and that's what determines what those coefficients are. If we change basis, then those coefficients change. But we can change basis in the tangent and cotangent spaces without changing coordinate system first.
How is that possible? I'm still confused because see, we have x, y, z, and we rotate it to x prime, y prime, z prime. The unit vectors pointing along x will now.
No. The vector is the same, even if you change coordinate system. Think of a vector in a tangent space as being some fixed vector. If you change basis in that vector space, it doesn't change the vector.
It doesn't change.
And as long as you don't change the basis, the coefficients in the expansion also don't change. So similarly for the curvature, for the metric and the Christoffel symbols. We just plug in our basis vectors here, and we get coefficient matrices.
The coefficients do change, sir. The projection of the vector on the axis, they change, and hence the coefficients change.
Yeah, if you choose different axes, but we are not choosing different axes.
But isn't choosing the basis like choosing different axes? Because the basis...
That's right, but we don't choose a different basis.
Vectors pointing along
that's
the axis.
That's right, but keep in mind that if we change coordinate system, there is no reason to change bases in the tangent space. Just because you're changing coordinate system doesn't mean you have to change bases in the tangent space.
So it would be as though if you started out with some vector 3x plus 2y, you know, where the x's and y's are all unit vectors, you would essentially be renaming x hat and y hat, but you wouldn't be changing the actual vector. You would have three of x hat expressed in different coordinates plus two y hat expressed in different coordinates. That three and that two, which are the four.
But no, it's not simple here because you simply keep the same basis.
Right.
It's the same vector, same basis, so nothing changes really in the tangent space.
Yeah, I was just trying to understand more.
Yeah.
General case.
Okay. One thing though that will change is that if this is the basis we want to work with all the time. Okay. This is the basis. Then you may first specify the basis by choosing the coordinate system and choosing your function z, right? And now, for some reason, you may want to change coordinate system without changing basis in the tangent spaces. Well, but that means that, of course, this function will change, right? And this is going to be this is some alpha tilde ij of y dxy, dy, okay? And you can calculate what the alpha tilde is from the alpha. But the point is, those guys stay the same. Okay, so it definitely takes some getting used to, right? those indices don't transform the way that physicists would normally think that indices have to transform. It's an upper index, I change coordinate system, I have to multiply this thing with dx, y by dx, j matrix, right? Not true. It's only true if you choose your basis always to be associated to the coordinate system. Once you decouple that, it has nothing to do with it. Okay, so now let's assume we change coordinate system, so we do exactly this. We have theta expressed in one coordinate system and we have it expressed in another coordinate system, which means that, this is if you want to keep the basis, but you change coordinate system, right? Now, what if you want to change your basis? Remember, you can do that even if you stay with the same coordinate system. So we used to use this basis in the cotangent space, for example. And now we think, I changed my mind. I want to use another basis. So I want to use a basis of theta. And you're free to do so. So this is the change of basis matrix. And analogously, or along with that, you want to change the basis of the dual vector space as well, of course. And then, so just to let the basis stay dual, to see if those guys are dual to another, so the theta I evaluated on an EJ gives you a conical delta IJ, and you want that the theta bar evaluated on an E bar gives you also a conical delta IJ, then this implies that if you change basis from the theta to the theta bar with an A matrix, then you have to change basis from the E to the E bar using the A inverse. That's just linearity. Okay, so we can choose basis there. And if we choose basis, then the contravariant indices are going to transform like that. The upper indices are going to transform like that. And the lower indices are going to transform like that. Keep in mind, it has nothing to do with change of coordinates. Okay. So far, so good. Now, this other ingredient that we wanted to do, tensor value deforms. What is it? RS tensor value deform. They call it phi. So when is phi an RS tensor value deform? Huh? Such an object is an anti-symmetric p-multilinear mapping at each point of the length, which is really just a fancy way of saying it's a totally anti-symmetric covariant tensor. So the phi is an object that takes p contravariant entries, so you can feed it p tangent vectors, for example, and out you get not a number or a scalar function, but out you get an RS tensor. You see, for differential forms, it would be just the same business here, except that out would, what you would get out is a function, and it's totally anti-symmetric. See, anti-symmetric p multilinear mapping. So it's totally the totally anti-symmetric map that eats up p contravariant vectors and spits out a function. That's what the differential form would do. An RS tensor value p form is something that also eats up p contravariant components, but as output it gives you an RS tensor. Now you can look at the components of this thing. So we choose our basis now. Again, the thetas, the e's, remember, they're totally independent of the choice coordinate system. And we just feed that. So the output of this thing is an RS tensor, which means that we can feed it R cotangent vectors, and we can feed it S tangent vectors, and evaluate the whole thing to a number. And that number is this number. So this phi, with an upper index running from I1 to IR, lower index from J1 to J rho, is a number, but one thing that is suppressed in notation is that this thing itself is actually P4. Okay. What is displayed here with this index structure is only the output part of the RS tensor value P4. So this thing can be fed P tangent vectors, and it will output an RS tensor, which, when fed all those R covectors and S vectors, evaluates to this particular number. In the case of ordinary 0-0 tensor value p forms, so just regular p forms, this thing has no indices. It's a p form, all right, but it has no indices. So those indices reflect the output structure of the differential form. These are the component p forms relative to the basis e. So if you hold your I1 to IR and J1 to J rho fixed, then this is really just a number by the default. And they are the and each one of those is called a component default. Remember, you may wonder, you know, come, this is a component value p form. Can I really do this? I cannot just look at the matrix and say that its entries are scalars. Yeah, but look at it. We chose those bases here fixed. Those coefficients don't change if you change coordinate system. They don't change when you change coordinate system. It has nothing to do with coordinate system. So you can really look at each entry itself. And each entry in this big matrix is a p form. It's a number valued p form. Relative to these bases. So it's not a proper scalar. It's relative to these bases. But it doesn't change as you change coordinates. Special cases. This is a very general framework and it applies to. Let's just for fun look at special cases. For example, RS tensors. So R4 contravariant, S4 covariant tensors. Can also be viewed as RS tensor valued 0 form. Okay. Because what we do here is that this RS tensor has no covariant and asymmetric components that we are interpreting as a form, but it's always a function. And so we can always view this as being a zero form with output of an RS tensor. It's just a trivial case. Just giving a different name to it. So in other words, every tensor is a zero form that has that takes values in whatever tensor it starts out with. Similarly, what are p-forms? P-forms can also be viewed as zero-zero tensor value forms. Because what does a p-form do? It feeds on p tangent vectors and outputs a function, a scalar, which is a zero-zero. So these are the two extreme cases. An arbitrary generic RS tensor is always an RS tensor valued zero form, and the p-form can also be viewed as a zero-zero tensor valued form. And the interesting situation is, of course, the intermediate situation, where part of your tensor is a form and part of it is tensorial. It's just a tensor. All right, that's a very abstract, but let's look at the concrete applications of this. Look, for example, at the torsion map. It's anti-symmetric. But remember that it outputs a contravariant tensor. Remember that the torsion tensor has one contravariant index and two covariant indices. And this is saying that the covariant indices are actually anti-symmetric. So that's great. It means that we can view the torsion tensor as a two-form. In fact, as a 1-0 tensor valued two-form. So if you look at the torsion map, what it does is it takes two contravariant tensors and swallows them up and gives you as the output a contravariant tensor. So we can view this now in the following way. We have here our torsion two form. It feeds on two tangent vectors and then outputs a tangent vector. And here is a basis of tangent vector space. So definitely, there are some coefficients that will give us the right vector. So therefore, this thing here is a 1-0 tensor value 2-form. Feeds on two tangent vectors and gives us one tangent vector. And it not only feeds on two tangent vectors, it does so anti-symmetric. That's why we can view it as a form. So the theta I, this being the contravariant index of its output, the theta I, since it is a two form, can be expanded in a basis of all two forms, of the space of all two forms, and the expansion coefficient, as is not hard to see, is just simply given by that matrix that we defined above by just assigning the basis vectors in J. So the 1-0 tensor value 2 form, that is the torsion form, can be given in this way. Notice that it is a 2 form, it is a linear combination of those guys, but it has one spare index. That is telling us what it's outputting. Outputting contravariant vectors. Similar thing can be done for the curvature form. Remember that this curvature map here, and remember that was one of the uses of R, okay, this thing here is anti-symmetric and feeds on two tangent vectors, and what does it output? It outputs the 1-1 tensor. Okay. So the Riemann curvature tensor, remember, has four indices, it's anti-symmetric in the last two indices, that's what this expresses, and then there's one upper and one lower index left over. So what we have is that this curvature map, remember what it does, it takes three tangent vectors, psi, eta, and for example, the base vector EI, and it maps the whole thing into a tangent vector. So that can therefore be written in this way, where we invent a new symbol omega, ij. This thing is a 2-form. It feeds on two covariant, it feeds on two contravariant vectors, anti-symmetrically. And then it still outputs those two, it still has two, those two indices here. So the I contracts with this one just to make sure that we have the tangent vector index. Here I just reminded you exactly of what this R is doing. Okay, so what we have is so far is a 1-0 tensor value curvature torsion 2 form, and we have a 1-1 tensor value curvature 2 form. If we choose our basis in the cotangent space to be a theta I, and we know that since this is a 2-form, we can write it as a linear combination of the spaces in the space of 2-forms, and it's not easy to check that these are the coefficients. And remember, it's just like a usual 2-form, just some coefficients, coefficient matrix contracted with the bases in the space of 2-forms, but on top of that, we have two spare indices, which tell us that this is not regular 2-form, it's a 2-form that actually outputs a 1-1 tensor. See, the advantage later on, a few lectures down the road, is going to be that if we identify the, one of the advantages is going to be that if we identify the form part, we know that we can integrate those things. For example, in order to get conservation laws in general. Okay, so we identified that the torsion is a form, the curvature tensor is a differential form. What about the connection now? Can the affine connection be identified as a form? Well, not really, right? Because it's not a tensor even to start with.
Right, I have a question about the previous page.
Okay.
Why do you write it as R E J besides knowing that you want it to be a 1-1 tensor value?
What do you mean by R E J? Where does it say R E J?
You have R, and then with xi, eta, and then E J.
Oh, this thing here.
Yeah.
Well, remember that was the very definition of the Riemann curvature tensor map, right? It mapped three tensors, three tangent vector fields into a tangent vector field.
So it's also eating the.
Yeah, remember the letters R had three meanings. One was the Riemann curvature tensor, one was the Riemann curvature map, and the other one was this R. And the Riemann curvature tensor map is the map that takes three contravariant vectors the maps then into, it takes xi, eta, and the third one, the ej, and maps them into this.
Okay, so I guess maybe it should have been in a bracket then, or is it just notation?
Yeah, it's probably just a matter of notation.
Okay.
Yeah, please just scroll back in your notes and then look that up. It's a pity that the symbol R stands for all those things. Okay, so the Christoffel symbols, what are they doing again? They tell us what the parallel transport is of tangent vectors. And the trouble is that this matrix here is not describing the tensor from the beginning. So how can we view it as a form? And on top of that, it's not even anti-symmetric in anything. Kj is not anti-symmetric. In fact, if it had an anti-symmetric component, it would be a torsion. In general relativity, it would have only a symmetric component. So what can we do there? Well, we can push it, and it turns out it is useful sometimes to push it and to define the connection one form. The idea there is that if you just take any covariant component, it's going to be one form. You see, one form is simply any covariant component. It doesn't have to be anti-symmetric. It's just one index. It can't be anti-symmetric with respect to anything.
So how are the omegas defined above a two form, because one index was at the top and one index was at the bottom?
Which one, the capital omega or this one?
So the omega at the top, the way you were defined.
Remember that it's not anti-symmetric with respect to those. This is just the values that it takes. This is the output. And the input indices are suppressed. They're just those k and l. And it's anti-symmetric in those. No, it's one tensor value form.
Yes, but you have defined it as a curvature two form.
Yes, that's what it is.
Yeah, but
it's a two form. It's a two form because it's a two form, right? And then you have those two indices left over, and that's the values in it. So what we do here is we just pick one of those indices here, the k, and we say that with respect to this index, it's a one form. We will have to find out why that is a useful thing to do. But remember, it's good to have forms because you can integrate this. So it's a one form, and one forms could be integrated along a one dimensional submany form. And that's, of course, exactly what you would want to do for a connection. Integrate along the line to get the parallel transport along the path. Anyway, we're not there yet. So you take the connection one form to be this thing here. You take the Christoffel symbol and contract with the first index here, and that makes it a one form, all right. But then where does it take values in? This I and j, they're not tensor indices. So it's a one form, all right, that's for sure, but what values does it take? And it turns out that...
So these indices are not tensor indices?
No, they're not tensor indices. Right, so what we can then, with this notation here, we can say that the covariant derivative of a tangent vector, a basis tangent vector, is what you get when you evaluate the tensor one form, the connection one form, onto the direction vector. So you feed it the direction vector, and as you do that, you just get the Christoffel symbol here, and then contract it with the EJ. See, the covariant derivative of psi k e k of EJ is what you get when you take the psi in front. Remember, we had just simple linearity, the first in the direction vector. You just put this in front. So that the value has to be the same. So remember keep in mind what that means. It means that if you want to covariantly differentiate a basis vector, tangent vector, in the direction of xi, then you get the action of a matrix on that basis vector. And which matrix you get depends on the dimensional direction that you're differentiating in. So this is a matrix, but its values only become clear once you feed it a direction, because it's a one form. It feeds a direction. Okay? That's what it does. So in the future, when we differentiate a basis vector covariantly in some direction, what we will do is we will feed the direction vector into the connection one form. That gives us a matrix, which we contract our basis vector.
Explain.
Yes?
If I just correctly, when we define the connection one form, we could just contract theta chi with any other indices with gamma. And we could write, for example, like gamma I k j theta j. Am I right?
In general relativity, we could do that.
But it's just convenient to do this like you wrote. But it's just convenient to do this like you wrote.
Yes, that's right. But
so this is the only reason, yeah? Like, okay.
Now here's a proposition, namely, how does the covariant derivative now look for covariates? This is the covariant derivative of vectors. What is the covariant derivative of covectors now? Well, that's not too hard to evaluate now. It turns out that this is, and I'll prove it in a moment, that the covariant derivative of basis vector theta I in the Coulombian space is then again given by the action of a matrix on basis vectors, and the values of the matrix are given once you give the direction vector, because it's a one form that feeds by direction. And in order to derive this, you simply require, or you know that the theta and the EI are dual bases to another. We've chosen them in this way. And therefore, we know that if you radiate the one on the other, we get the Kronecker delta. Now, obviously, if you differentiate the Kronecker delta, then you get a zero. But we also know that the covariant derivative is obeying a Leibniz rule. And therefore, we can put the covariant differentiation inside this evaluation. Remember, it doesn't matter whether you first evaluate the covariant derivative and then evaluate the action of vectors and covectors, or the other way around. So we can write this using the Leibniz rule as the sum of those two terms. But we do know already what the covariant derivative on the EI is. And the covariant derivative on the EI is given by that, on the action of the omega matrix, of the affine, of the connection one form. And this is the thing that we want to find out. We know that the sum of the two is zero. So we can work out what this actually is. It has to be true for all basis vectors. And from that, you can read out that has to be true. Now, we were warned, of course, that the connection one forms are non-tensorial. We know that those guys are not transforming the way that a tensor would. We found that out when we still worked with basis vectors that come with coordinate systems. Now that we work with basis vectors that do not necessarily come with coordinate systems, the whole situation cannot have changed. But somehow we still have to recover what's going on. So let's do this. Under a change of frame, under a change of basis, remember, a frame is simply a choice of basis for every tension space and every Coulomb space. So as we change our basis from thetas to theta bars, even if we keep the coordinate system the same, it's independent of that, if we change the frame, then the transformation for the omega bar is this, and it's not what it ought to be for tensors. Remember that we calculated just a few slides back that that a change of basis in the tangent spaces is associated with the change of coefficients for our vectors and tensors and so on, which is strictly going by upper and lower indices, with the A, lower indices with the inverse array. And now we see that the connection one form is transforming like this, as we see here. And that will tell us that it's not, that tells us that this is certainly not tensorial, because that would have to be absent. So let us prove what this is. First of all, what is the structure of this thing? This is a one form. Okay, it has those extra indices, but that's just the values that the form takes. Now, the omega is a one form. Those guys are just functions. Functions multiplied with a one form is a one form. You can view them as zero forms, right? And this is the extra derivative of a zero form, so it's a one form. And that's just functions again, so the whole thing is a one form. So the overall structure of this business is that it's a one. Now we have lots of indices in this, and it's easier to suppress the indices and just view those things as matrices. So for example, the omega bar is simply A matrix multiplied with the omega matrix multiplied with the A inverse matrix, and so on. This is a matrix, that's a matrix. So if you view things this way, then we can prove, let me just check, we are running out of time and everything. Today took much longer than I thought. Right, so let me skip that proof. It's all spelled out in here, and I'd like to invite you to read that yourself and check back with me if you struggle understanding it. So now the absolute exterior differential D. This operation is going to generalize both the exterior derivative and the covariant derivative. So more general and in order than that. Here's a composition that we've not proved here. I'm referring you to the book by Stroman. The claim is that for every RS tensor value T form phi, there exists an RS tensor value P plus 1 form B phi, which we obtained by applying this absolute exterior differential D on it, whose components relative to an arbitrary choice of basis theta are given in this way. So what is it doing? The absolute exterior derivative is the ordinary exterior derivative on the form part of it. Okay? You see, if, let's say, we look at the extreme case where we have a 0, 0 tensor value to differential form. These are the differential forms that we've always dealt with. Just number values or function values differential forms. In this case, the phi has no indices whatsoever. Phi is simply a differential form. It has no indices whatsoever. It's B form. And then with this exterior, absolute exterior differential is applied to phi, there are no indices here, simply D, little D applied to phi. And since there are no indices to contract, those terms are absent. So if we are dealing with the 0, 0 tensor value P form, then the absolute exterior differential is simply the ordinary exterior derivative, no extra terms. Now let's look at the other extreme. Let's say the thing is not a form at all. Phi is not a form, it's a zero form, but it's RS tensor value. So it's really just an RS tensor. And as far as the form part is concerned, it's a zero form, right? I mean, every RS tensor can be viewed as a zero form too, strictly. So let's assume this extreme case where we're dealing with an RS tensor value zero form. Now in this case, this phi here, the phi is a zero form, but it has all those tensor indices, right? So as far as the form part is concerned, it's driven just a function, but it has lots of tensors. Now what is this absolute exterior differential doing now? And now it's the regular covariant derivative. Because what does it do? if this is just a function, as far as the format is concerned, then d of it is the d of a function, which is just the ordinary derivative. Okay? D on functions is the ordinary derivative. And what are those things? These are just the ordinary terms with the Christoffel symbols, plus and minus, for the contravariant and the covariant pi's. Just the Christoffel symbols contracted with the tensor components of phi. So remember how the ordinary covariant derivative works. The ordinary covariant derivative of a tensor works by first differentiating the tensor ordinarily, ordinary derivative, just a comma, not a semicolon, just a comma, and then plus Christoffel symbol contracted with all the contravariant minus Christoffel symbol contracted with all the covariant. Right? This is how it works. And that's what it reduces to if the thing here is purely a tensor and the form part is trivial because it's a zero part. So in two extreme cases, when it's not a form at all, just a tensor, then it's just a covariant derivative. In the other extreme case, where the thing is really a P form and it's not tensor valued at all, it's a zero zero tensor value, then it's just the ordinary exterior derivative. But the interesting part is, of course, the intermediate case where it's a P form, that's our S tensor value. And in this case, this is still a valid derivative, meaning that this is a covariant definition. It doesn't depend on which coordinate system, for example, you use to write this stuff. And that this really, as output, this operation as its output really gives you a P plus 1 differential form, an RS tensor value P plus 1 form. This is what has to be shown in order to prove that this is a valid derivative here, and that's being done, for example, in the expression on. See, this is a very handy notation here because, of course, we would want to differentiate our tensor value differential forms. Now, instead of just writing down the definition up there, we could have derived that definition from requirements. And what we would have to require is that D is an antiderivation. But since we already make the definition here, that is a proposition now that can be derived, that can be concluded from that definition. Special cases, as we already said, that an ordinary P form is a zero, zero tensor value form, so the habitat is simply the willing D. We also already discussed that if we are dealing with a tensor value 0 form, then the capital D is simply the covariant derivative. So we found sort of common denominator. I put it here as an exercise to verify that, but I already really gave it away how you do it. Now, one of the first benefits that you will get from all of this business is that some key equations simplify. So an affine connection is a metric. We can now say if and only if its its absolute covariant derivative is zero. It's not that big of a step. I mean, before it was a covariant derivative, but it's just not a form, therefore it's the same thing. But more interestingly, those structure equations, we get structure equations and Bianchi identities and they look relatively simple. So let me just throw this out there. We are basically out of time, but so that it won't be completely new to you when we do that next time. We obtain the so-called Cantor structure equation. This is the torsion one form. Remember that the torsion tensor has three components. One tensor index is up, two are lower, they're anti-symmetric, they're back to the form. So that's the torsion two form. It's the 1-0 tensor value torsion two form. It turns out that for mathematical reasons, just like the Bianchi identities, the torsion one form obeys this equation. It's the programming, it's the exterior derivative of the one form of our coordinate system. And remember by this argument here, those one forms no longer have d theta equal to zero, but they have some non-trivial behavior here as two forms. So the exterior derivative of those one forms that are our frame are some non-trivial two form plus the omega ij theta j. And what you can see from this is, and the definition that we just had of the absolute covariant derivative, we find that the torsion is simply the exterior derivative of our one form, of our frame. See? So you see things simplify quite dramatically here. You see that the torsion is the covariant derivative of our frame. And you know, just put in the definitions of what those things are. I give you some hints about this to see how that comes about. And similarly, the curvature two form, right, it's a two form, but it has also two, the curvature tensor also has two spare indices, so it's a 1-1 tensor value two form, actually takes this formulation here. And I spelled out exactly how we prove. Someone proves that this is the case. I don't have time to do this. I even skipped one step here, I think, and I've given that to fill it in. But again, if you have any questions about that, and you try it yourself, please ask at any time. And then the point about this, the Cartan structure equation is that, and this is really reaping the benefit of all this going abstract here, is that those complicated Bianchi identities now take a much simpler form, which is really what we need in order to make any use of it. Because once they are, and as long as they are so complicated as they used to be when we first encountered the Bianchi identities, they were not much use because it was hard to recognize where and when they would occur. But now, in terms of the new formulation, we can write that the absolute derivative of the torsion one form is simply the curvature torsion two form is simply the curvature two form that the frame. And remember that the torsion one form, the torsion two form itself is the exterior derivative of the frame. And the second Bianchi identity takes the simple form that the absolute derivative of the curvature two form is vanishing. And that means that we have two very useful equations at the end that we will use in general relativity. Namely, in general relativity, the torsion vanishes, so this thing vanishes. Therefore, we have that the Riemann curvature tensor expressed as the curvature two form, which the frame field is zero. So we have this useful equation. You see, this is not so easy, not so hard to imagine that that sort of combination comes up quite a bit. And whenever it comes up, we know it's zero. And similarly, the second Bianchi identity now takes a relatively simple form. It's just that the absolute covariant derivative of the Riemann of the curvature two form is vanishing. And one last thing. In the case of a metric connection, so remember so far we didn't actually use the fact that the metric can be related to the affine connection. Now let us come back to making that connection. When we first made the connection, we chose as our basis vectors those guys, the ones that come with the coordinate system. Okay? And then we got a certain relationship between the metric and the Christoffersen. But now we free ourselves from this choice. Let's see what happens. Well, if we free ourselves from that choice, then the Cartan equations give us four arbitrary bases, those theta here, that the Christoffel servers are still related to the metric, all right, but in a somewhat more complicated fashion. We get those terms as well as those that we had before. These were the terms that we got in the first calculation, if we choose the canonical basis that comes from the coordinate system. And here we get extra terms that have those coefficients c. Remember what the c's were? If you take the exterior derivative of the theta, you get a twofold. And the c are the expansion coefficients of that in the basis of twofold. Oh, here it is. Sorry. Here it is. Like d theta is those expansion coefficients times that basis of twofold. So they occur in here. And remember that if you choose your coordinate system and then you choose your basis vectors to be those, then those c completely vanish. Because you have d of x, which is 0. So all of this stuff completely goes away. All the coefficients c go away. And the Christoffel symbol is related to the metric in this simple way. Also, we had an expression for the Riemann curvature tensor in terms of Christoffel symbols. And we had it so far only up to those four terms. Now, there's an additional term with the c in this. So at this point, you may think, well, wait a moment. What sort of deal was that? We introduced this C matrix. We have three choices of bases now. And now look what price we had to pay. We got those equations here that are a little bit hard to understand. Simple, right? But hard to understand. But at least there was a promise of simplicity. And now we get these complications here. We get this all this mess here, and we get this extra term over there. So where's the simplicity in all of this, right? Maybe starting to complain about it. Thing is this. Price is well worth paying. It's well worth paying the price of having this extra term here and having those extra terms over there. For one, let me just give one concrete reason that should convince you of this. Once we are free, once we do no longer choose the basis to be that, we are free to choose any basis we want. And in particular, we will be free to choose the basis such that the metric G mu nu is going to be minus 1, 1, 1, 1, everywhere. Everywhere. We are free to choose the basis such that this is so. And you can imagine that this is going to be very useful. Okay? As long as you choose your basis to be connected to the choice of coordinate system, you have a very limited choice of basis. It's automatic with your coordinate system. And as we established some lectures back, in this case, you can only ever achieve this at one point at a time. If you want to have it another point, you have to choose another coordinate system. If you want to have another point, you have to choose another coordinate system. You can do it everywhere, but not everywhere at once. Okay? But once we are free to choose our basis arbitrarily, then we can choose at every point that basis which would be the basis of that coordinate system at that point, right? The suitably chosen coordinate system. And that comes in very handy, that the metric tensor coefficients end up to be just that. For example, when we will discuss the Dirac equation on curved space, because if you remember, the Dirac equation required that you introduce gamma matrices whose anti-commutator is the metric. And if the metric of the matrix varies from point to point, then from point to point, you need to introduce new gamma matrices, which would really be headed. But if you can keep the metric to be as simple as that, then you have much easier to generalize the Dirac equation to curved space. That's one of the things that you would use this for. So you see, in principle, this is a high price to pay, but you see, a lot of this stuff, you just go out if that is constant. all the g comma something drop out, because they're going to be constant. And you're just left with only the c terms. All right. Any questions? Oh, yes, I have a question for you. I heard that science students have to go to some event on Thursday. Is that confirmed?
It's the 19th, basically like an academic standard lecture they have to go to graduate.
I think we only have the offer once per term, and we only have to vote it once before we graduate.
Oh, so we can go next.
So we can go next term before.
Oh, would that be okay? Because otherwise we are a little bit in trouble. Is that okay?
Yeah, it's okay with me.
Yeah,
as long as nobody's catch.
Okay, nobody has a concern then about Thursday's double lecture then?
I think a lot of us already think for that academic. It's not that.
Yeah, and if not, I mean, it's only really concerned for those who want to graduate very quickly and happen to.
Well, and, you know, if you can get rid of it live, like I've done with Misconduct, for sure.
Oh, it's next week.
But of course, in principle, logically, we should do that in like the first term, right? Not in the past. Keep all your Misconduct until the very last term, then you have to do that. All right, okay, so Thursday then the double lecture.
That's the
start. Okay, super.